And we just built a very large, heavy structure on top of a very weak foundation. So it just creates a fundamentally unstable snowpack.
After heavy new snow, Chugach avalanche experts say stay out of the backcountry. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska Native Arts Foundation celebrates 10 years of featuring art from across the state.
My vision is to not only promote their work, but to tell the story of who they are, where they come from.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
After minimal snowfall earlier this winter, South Central Alaska finally saw significant snow accumulation with the Christmas Eve storm. But with the new snow comes an increased avalanche danger. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The avalanche advisory for the Turnagain area is a 4 out of 5 or high. Kevin Wright is the director of the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. He says we have an exceptionally bad setup right now.
All the early snow, the small amounts that we got in early winter in October and November, they basically transformed into this very loose sort of sugar snow that just falls apart. And then just over the last few days, we got about 3 feet of new storm snow on top of that. And we just built a very large, heavy structure on top of a very weak foundation. So it just creates a fundamentally unstable snowpack.
Wright says his office has documented a number of natural avalanches since the storm. Department of Transportation highway crews have been doing explosive mitigation work to prevent avalanches along the Seward Highway, but human-triggered avalanches are very likely, both above and below the tree line, Wright says. And although it might be tempting to take new skis or snow machines to the mountains, he recommends staying out of the backcountry.
If you're in steep mountainous terrain, there aren't too many ways to do it safely. So the safest bet is to go places like Alyeska or just flatter terrain where you're not going to find avalanches.
He says some of the worst areas are along the Seward Highway and above Turnagain Pass. And if the next storm brings in more precipitation, as forecasters predict, we can expect more of the same. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Links to information are at our website, alaskapublic.org. On Kodiak Island, the body of a Coast Guardsman missing since Saturday was recovered yesterday on Barometer Mountain. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has the story.
Alaska State Troopers led the search for 20-year-old Derek Russell, who was last seen on Saturday when he reportedly told friends he was going to hike Barometer. Russell was reported missing Sunday night around 6 p.m. Coast Guard helicopters from Air Station Kodiak conducted aerial searches Sunday night, and members of the Coast Guard, Kodiak Island Search and Rescue, and community volunteers searched the areas near the trail on Christmas Eve. Search efforts continued on Christmas Day, and 3 search dogs and 4 handlers were flown in from Anchorage to help. Nick Zabo is a member of Kodiak's Search and Rescue and said search teams were flown to the summit of the mountain yesterday.
They discovered some skid marks from the summit going down as if someone had started to slide off the mountain. Then they followed the skid marks down and they found an ice axe, which resembled the description of the one that Mr. Russell had taken up with him. And then they started following the skid marks further and they found him partially buried in the snow about halfway down the mountain. It looked like he'd probably slid about 1,000 feet.
Sarah Francis is the spokeswoman for the Coast Guard and said Russell was a fireman on the Coast Guard Cutter Monroe and relatively new to Kodiak. She said his body was recovered from the mountain shortly after being discovered yesterday afternoon.
He was returned to the base here in Kodiak aboard a Coast Guard helicopter. And Coast Guard Cutter Monroe, working with our other shipmates out on the East Coast, have notified his family of this tragic incident.
Russell's body will be sent to the state medical examiner so the actual cause of death can be determined. I'm Brianna Gibbs.
Another seafood processor is planning to operate in Bristol Bay. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The first announcement that Silver Bay Seafoods was planning to open a processing facility in Bristol Bay came in late November on the Deck Boss blog run by veteran Alaska journalist Wesley Loy. The company has apparently purchased 8 acres of industrial zone property on the Naknek River adjacent to the Leader Creek Seafoods facility. The company plans to construct a high-volume processing plant on that land that will have the daily capacity to process and freeze 2.4 million pounds of salmon and 900 tons of herring. To pay for construction of the plant, Silver Bay Seafoods is offering to sell ownership interest for $25,000 for each 0.1% of the new company called Silver Bay Seafoods Naknek LLC. The news that a new seafood processor is coming to the Bay has been met with enthusiasm by many stakeholders in the Bay's commercial salmon fishery, including the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, which is the community development quota organization for Bristol Bay. Robin Samuelson is a commercial fisherman and the CEO of BBEDC.
The processing capacity at Bristol Bay is way down from 10, 20 years ago, and it's good to see a fresh company like Silver Bay come into Bristol Bay to process salmon and pay fishermen a fair price. We own 50% of Ocean Beauty that has a major plant in Naknek. I have joy that Silver Bay is coming in and going to compete with us, and the fishermen are going to benefit.
The new processing facility in Naknek is scheduled to be up and operating in May of 2014, and the initial $25 million is expected to cover the actual cost of the real estate and the costs associated with building the new processing facility. Apparently, Silver Bay Seafoods has already put up over $2 million to purchase the land for the new facility. The new company will apparently be led by a 5-person board of representatives. Silver Bay Seafoods is a relatively new player in the seafood processing industry in Alaska, and it currently runs facilities in Sitka, Craig, and Valdez. Silver Bay Seafoods apparently plans to have a fishing fleet capable of harvesting 18% of the annual drift net harvest in Bristol Bay, and they hope to be able to buy 30% of the annual Togiak Sacro herring harvest. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an amazing adoption story brings a family together.
I don't think she ever intended to tell me. It was not intentional. I think it was just, it came out. And once it was out, she couldn't take it back.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at GrantStation.com.
The Alaska Native Arts Foundation is celebrating its 10-year anniversary. The foundation's gallery is in downtown Anchorage, but Trina Landlord, the executive director, says they now have a registry of more than 1,100 Alaska Native artists from across the state. She says beyond showcasing art and helping build economies in rural Alaska, the foundation offers training in art production and business for artists.
My vision is to not only promote their work, but to tell the story of who they are, where they come from, because there's so much meaning there. In the past years, my ancestors did not have a word for art. Everything was utilitarian in nature, and now pieces are we carry traditional and contemporary artwork.
Well, you're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, and although you haven't been here for the full 10 years, clearly you know a lot about the philosophy behind it. What do you envision the next 10 years will look like?
The next 10 years, I'd like to continue on the upward mobility of continuing to work with artists. And I believe that we have this generation of emerging artists, and what I'd like to do is continue to showcase and feature and continue to build on the exhibitions, and being able to showcase their new works. The next big event that we are going to be hosting is our 10-year anniversary fashion show, and it's called Where Art Thou? It's going to take place in April 2013, and it's all about wearable art and be able to showcase everything from sealskin business suits, power suits, all the way to jewelry and other types of contemporary fashions.
Would you say, Trina, that there is a typical client or customer that comes through the door here, or who do you see?
We do not have a typical client that comes through. We have worked with people from all over the globe. We have tourists that come in during the summer months, and they can be anywhere from our closest destination, like Seattle, all the way. I've met people that come from France and Spain and Germany. And then we have our local Alaskans that want to see what we're up to, and so they come in and come to First Friday events. So it's a broad range. We have tourists from all across the globe and local Alaskans and art collectors that come in. So it's a broad spectrum of our art audience.
There seems to be a growing, you mentioned an emerging generation of Alaska Native artists, and there seems to be kind of a growing urban Native art scene here in Anchorage. How is the Arts Foundation connected to that, and how do you work together?
Over the last summer, we had the awesome opportunity to work with Nicholas Galanin. He's a Tlingit and Aleut contemporary artist based out of Sitka, and we worked with him and his brother Jared in conducting a master artist workshop where we brought in five emerging artists who worked with silver and copper as a new medium. And so that's just an example of working with this emerging artist scene and really being able to connect them with established artists and provide a platform for them to gain exposure through the Arts Foundation with buying and selling their artwork.
Trina Landlord is the executive director of the Alaska Native Arts Foundation. The foundation is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Pictures and links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Volunteers gathered in South Fairbanks last weekend for the first in a handful of events leading up to the start of the 30th running of the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race on February 2nd. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, they were tasked with cranking out 5,000 trail markers for the event.
The sound of staple guns echoes inside a large, dusty warehouse in South Fairbanks. 4-foot-long wooden trail markers are spread out between sawhorses all over the place. Mark Winterstein will man this year's final Yukon Quest checkpoint and finish line in Fairbanks. He spreads thick stripes of hot pink and black paint across the tops of wooden stakes laid out in front of him.
It's always kind of like a milestone of the winter, you know. Once the quest starts, then you know as soon as it's over, it's almost March, and then the spring's coming, and so that's pretty good.
Once the painting's done, small square pieces of reflective tape are secured with staples. Race manager Alex Olison says Quest volunteers make 10,000 trail markers each year. 5,000 go to the Canadian side of the trail, and 5,000 mark the Alaskan side.
You just have to have a couple thousand ready by their first trail breaking session, which comes here early in January.
This year, Olison says inmates from the White Horse Correctional Center volunteered to make the markers for Canada.
And they did them because they're a captive audience. They were able to do them in small chunks, but just every day for like a month and a half or something, they did a couple hundred a day or something.
Reports from Eagle, a checkpoint in the middle of the trail, indicate that the Yukon River froze at a high level this year and then shifted, creating areas of jumble ice. Further downriver, locals in Circle have told Olison the river is smooth. He says he won't know for sure what the trail's like until it's completely broken. Even then, conditions can change quickly.
You just have to assume that it's going to go to hell and then get ready for that. And then if it doesn't, then you're okay.
26 teams are signed up to leave the start line on February 2nd from Whitehorse for the 30th running of the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
8-year-old violinists and arts in Juneau schools have drawn the John F. Kennedy Center to the capital city. Representatives from the nation's Performing Arts Center are scoping out Juneau as a finalist for the Any Given Child program. It honors communities that provide high-quality arts education to all children. As KTOO intern Kelsey Gabrowski reports, Juneau is a finalist because of a unique music program called JAM.
The Juneau second graders retrieve their pint-sized violins, pick up their bows, and play the can-can. Two representatives from the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. clap, and one takes photos with his cell phone. On this day, 8-year-old violinist Amira Andrews is among the 24 violinists and 6 cellists performing at Glacier Valley Elementary School.
We have this thing called JAM after school, and we practice and we warm up and we practice songs.
Glacier Valley Elementary began the Juneau Alaska Music Matters program 3 years ago. JAM is one reason Juneau is a finalist in the Kennedy Center's National Any Given Child program. Former Juneau Arts and Humanities Council President Annie Calkins wrote Juneau's application.
The Any Given Child program was initiated by the Kennedy Center as a way to increase equity and access to arts education for students across this country in grades kindergarten through 8.
This isn't the first time the Kennedy Center has been interested in Glacier Valley Elementary. In 2007, the Juneau School was one of 5 National Schools of Distinction winners. Now, Juneau is looking to expand its arts education. That's where Any Given Child comes in. Calkins says city government officials, businesses, arts organizations, artists, and the school district organized a community arts team. If Juneau wins, Calkins says the community will join 10 other cities across America recognized by Any Given Child. No prize money comes with the distinction.
What we get from the Kennedy Center is up to 5 years of technical assistance and training and engagement with figuring out ways that Juneau can increase equity and access across all of our schools.
While the JAM program has expanded to 2 other elementary schools, Calkins says some Juneau schools have higher quality arts programs than others. The objective is to give more students access. Glacier Valley Elementary music teacher Lori Hagee started JAM.
I think what makes our application so strong for the Kennedy Center is the fact that they were astounded by how much a community of just over 30,000 can support a symphony, 3 opera companies, just the amount of arts organizations that are here and how we support them was very exciting for them, as well as the rich cultural heritage that we have here and how we celebrate that here in Juneau.
Hagee says the children build their skills in confidence, teamwork, and memory. Gokwa Shaw has been a private violin instructor for 2 decades. Hagee asked Shaw to teach students in the JAM program. Shaw says the students started when they were 5 years old, but without their parents in the room to coax them along. They learned how to navigate their first musical experience on their own.
When I first saw them, they just couldn't believe how little they are, a very small size. Now they grow, and also they can play better, because that's what I'm happy to see.
Now the students are in 2nd grade. 8-year-olds Garrett Strickler and Kitty Sweet are used to performing before an audience.
In JAM, we practice all of our songs just in case there's an assembly or like a concert.
I like when I play sounds and I can hear what I play. It makes beautiful sounds.
JAM students have formed quartets and are performing seasonal songs in Glacier Valley classrooms.
They are just so eager to absorb what they're learning that the pace at which they are accomplishing their musical skills on the violin has been astounding.
The Kennedy Center is expected to announce the winning community for any given child in the next couple of weeks. In Juneau, I'm Kelsey Gabrowski.
Bill Popp thought he knew his family. Popp is president of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, and his family is a close-knit, long-time Alaska clan who talk and gather often at Bill's house in East Anchorage. But last year, everything Bill thought he knew about his family changed, and all it took was one random Google search. Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley has the first story in a three-part series.
One Sunday last March, Bill and his wife Nicole were having a conversation with his daughter over Skype. Someone said his mother, Mary Lou, had a birthday coming up. How old was she going to be? Nicole said 75. Bill, in the mood to tease his wife, disagreed. He guessed 77, even though he knew Nicole was right. Nicole got frustrated. She typed Bill's mother's birthday and her maiden name, Mary Louise Hiraman, into Google.
The next thing I know, my wife is standing in front of me. Nicole comes up with the laptop, and she sticks it in front of me and says, "You need to look at this." And I look at it, and it's a adoption.com posting of a birth mother looking for a daughter that had been given up for adoption at birth. And the birth mother's name was our mother's name, Mary Louise Hiraman.
Her birth date was the same as his mother's. The baby had been born in Wyoming. That's where his mother grew up. The birth father's name, John Lockhart, was Bill's father's name. The listing said the baby had been born on April 23rd, 1961. That's 2 years after Bill was born. Bill couldn't process it.
This made zero sense.
Bill never knew his biological father. His parents divorced shortly after his birth, and his mother married Ken Popp years later. Ken adopted Bill when Bill was 10. His father agreed to give up his parental rights at that time. Bill says his biological father didn't want to pay child support.
My life, my world as I know it, is I have a younger brother and a younger sister, but the brother is 10 years younger, the sister is 12 years younger, and there's nobody in between.
Bill clicked a link on the adoption.com listing. It brought up a phone number in Vilseck, Germany. Bill's younger sister, Kristen, had been stationed there for years with her husband, who was in the army. Bill dug up her phone number from that time. It matched the number on the listing. There was also an email address. Bill decided to send a message. Maybe he thought it was all some kind of joke.
So I sent an email to the link saying, "Hi, my name is Bill Popp," and words to the effect of, "I think I'm a relative, and would you please contact me? Here's my phone number, da-da-da-da-da-da," and fired off the email.
Can you tell me how you were feeling at this time? Were you feeling anything?
Denial, shock, what the hell? None of it was connecting.
Later that day, Bill had plans to meet his family, including his sister, at the West High swimming pool for his nephew's birthday party. When he got there, he pulled his younger brother, Jeff, aside and told him what he'd found. Jeff was dumbfounded. Kristen arrived late, just as the cake was being served. Bill cornered her.
I catch Kristen's eye and, you know, say, "Come on over, let's go over and talk." She comes over and I ask her, "Is there something I need to know?" And she nods her head, yes.
Kristen and Bill met later at Bill's house. And that's when Kristen let go of a secret she'd been guarding for 26 years. She says it happened when she was 13 or 14 years old. And she was watching television with Mary Lou. It was a talk show, maybe Montel Williams. The subject? Mothers who gave up children for adoption.
We're watching this program and eventually I started thinking out loud. And I was like, well, why would you do it? You know, if nobody can make you give up your child, you know. And at that point, Mom just sort of burst into tears and just lost it. And I'm like looking at her, what the hell's going on, you know. And that's when she spilled the beans and she was, I had to. It was like we were in the moment. She was obviously emotional with watching this TV program and me voicing what was in my head. I don't think she ever intended to tell me. It was not intentional. I think it was just, it came out. And once it was out, she couldn't take it back.
After that, Mary Lou told Kristen a story that she'd been keeping secret since she was in her mid-20s. She made Kristen promise never to tell. Kristen didn't. For decades.
My feeling on this, even from the time I was a teenager, it's not my story to tell. She had asked me not to say anything, not to do anything. It wasn't my place to do it. I just wasn't willing to do that to her. I figure she'd been through enough after hearing this, what even the little bit of the story I knew, she'd been through enough. I wasn't going to betray her any further.
But several years later, in 2002, Mary Lou agreed that Kristen could create the adoption.com post.
Literally, I probably had my first computer for about a week and I was on the adoption websites with the information, looking. So it was my first opportunity to really start searching, you know, in any sort of serious way.
So you thought about it a lot?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Nearly a decade passed. Kristen almost forgot about it. Then she got an email from her brother, Bill. After telling Bill what she knew, Kristen called their mother. She says it was difficult telling her mom what happened. But there was another emotion, too.
I think part of it for me was it's like it's finally out. It's finally... It's not a secret anymore. Thank God.
I can only imagine what, you know, you weren't... Mom wasn't the only one with a load off. Mm-mm. You had to...
You know what? When that email came through the day of that party, it was like... It was relief. It was like, finally.
The next day, through tears at Bill's kitchen table, Mary Lou revealed the story behind that family secret.
That's Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley. This story is a collaboration with the Anchorage Daily News. Listen for part two of the story tomorrow on Alaska News Nightly. To see pictures of the Pop family, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Julia O'Malley in Anchorage, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Kelsey Gabrowski in Juneau. Our engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management, take daily medication, and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.